This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing and Gazelle Full Circle Resale. Now accepting like-new natural fiber clothing, jewelry, accessories, and curios. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-284-4192. This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
Be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Amin Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the NAACP joins protesters in calling for a new trial for a man convicted of killing a University of Oregon student. One of the largest grassroots organizations in the country faces new allegations of voter registration fraud, and up to 40 people are killed during a clash between rebel groups in southern Darfur.
And in the human cost of the U.S. occupation in Iraq, make that the U.S. invasion of Iraq. As of today, there have been 2,718 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, plus an additional 138 U.S. contractors killed. IraqBodyCount.org reports a minimum of 43,546 Iraqi civilians have been reported by the media as killed by the U.S. invasion. The website informationclearinghouse.info reports the true civilian casualty rate may be as high as a quarter million at a cost of $331 billion already allocated by the U.S. Congress. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 2nd, 2006. I'm Andy Seaton.
And I'm Lisa Lewis. Organizers of a march held along with a regional meeting of the NAACP called for a new trial for a man convicted of manslaughter in the death of a University of Oregon student last year. More than 100 people marched through downtown Salem on Saturday to protest against the conviction of Daryl Walker, son of former NBA guard Daryl Walker. In Eugene, in July, a judge denied a request for a new trial. Lawyers for Walker argued that a new jury should hear additional testimony suggesting that another man punched Philip Gillens as he was walking home with two friends in June 2005. Gillens fell, struck his head, and died 2 days later of a brain injury. The march was in conjunction with a regional conference of the NAACP in Alaska, Washington, and Oregon. Organizers said they hoped to raise awareness of the case of Walker, who was sentenced to more than 6 years in prison.
In Southern Oregon, Jackson County Commissioner C.W. Smith is a Republican, but he's not anxious for another visit from President Bush. Bush campaigned in Southern Oregon 2 years ago, and the county is still dealing with the costs. Law enforcement agencies racked up more than a quarter million dollars in extra manpower and overtime because of the visits from Bush and other politicians. And now, the county officials have to spend $20,000 to handle a lawsuit stemming from the president's visit to Jacksonville. The lawsuit is filed by the ACLU, alleges the U.S. Secret Service, state and local police acted with unnecessary violence and discrimination when clearing the Jacksonville streets for the visit. County officials would like the federal government to reimburse small cities for the cost of the campaign stops, asking only for 50% of the expenses.
State Representative Wayne Krieger recently challenged the Brandon Chamber of Commerce's ban on political entries in its annual Cranberry Festival Parade. A chamber volunteer told Krieger that he could walk in the parade as long as he displayed nothing that referred to his campaign for re-election. But the Gold Beach Republican handed out campaign leaflets as he walked the parade route with his granddaughter. Krieger said he walks in about 10 parades a year, and the Cranberry Festival is the only one attempting to take away his freedom of speech. Chamber contends that they have the right to decide what will be in the parade they sponsor. Chamber Executive Director Julie Miller says the chamber decided to bar politically oriented entries 3 years ago after a controversy over an anti-abortion entry.
Weeks before the midterm elections, a nationwide advocacy group is facing new allegations on registration fraud. ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, has had about 3,000 voter registration cards rejected by Philadelphia election officials. Election officials in Denver have also forwarded about 200 registration cards to Colorado investigators after they noticed similar handwriting on the signatures. An ACORN spokesman says they'll continue to register people to vote and will, quote, stand up, unquote, for voters' rights. But an Ohio advocate who shares ACORN's goals says the group has become its own worst enemy.
As the 2006 election approaches, debate is heating up on this year's crop of ballot measures. Brendan Wright has the details on one such debate about Measure 41.
To its backers, Measure 41 is a tax break aimed at helping the little guy and Oregon's middle-class families. Promoted by the Washington, D.C.-based group Freedom Works, Measure 41 would reduce state income taxes for many households by about $140 a person by giving Oregonians the option to take the same personal income tax deductions as on their federal return. Opponents say Measure 41 would hurt the people it's supposed to help by removing $400 million a year from the state budget. The Measure 41 campaign is being led by Russ Walker, head of the Oregon chapter of Freedom Works, which has worked around the country for reduced government regulations, lower government spending, and reduced taxes. Walker said he got the idea for the tax deduction measure from anti-tax crusader Bill Sizemore, and the signature-gathering drive for Measure 41 was bankrolled by Lauren Parks, the reclusive Nevada conservative who's funded many of Sizemore's past initiatives. Defending the measure, Walker notes that the state's latest revenue forecasts predict the state will have about $2 billion more in revenues in the 2007 to 2009 budget period than earlier predicted. Opponents say, however, that while the state will have a substantial budget surplus in the next 2 years, Measure 41 tax cuts will be in effect for years to come and could force state spending reductions if the economy turns down again. State Trooper Jeff Leahy, president of the Oregon State Police Officers Association, says passage of Measure 41 could thwart efforts next year to begin addressing a state trooper shortage. It will be harder to hire more troops if legislators know they will have $400 million less a year to spend on education and health programs in the coming years, Leahy said. I'm Brendan Wright, KBOO News.
The Libertarian candidate for the U.S. Senate seat in Washington, Bruce Guthrie, says he's putting his life savings, nearly $1.2 million, into the race against Washington Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell. Before this, the most recent FEC report had said Guthrie had raised just $31,000. The Seattle Times said the infusion of so much money from a dark horse candidate is sure to change the dynamic of the race. It's unclear whether Guthrie's beefed-up campaign will be a bigger benefit to Cantwell or to McGavick. The top issues are likely to attract liberal voters. He's a strong proponent of the same-sex marriage and is ardently anti-war. He also supports reducing the federal deficit. Guthrie said he's disappointed that money is what drives politics in this country, but he says he knows that if he doesn't give the campaign his best shot, he'll regret it later.
Washington Governor Christine Gregoire says she's unhappy with the explosion of special interest spending for judicial races. And she said today that she's exploring the idea of public financing. She also strongly endorsed her fellow Democrat, Maria Cantwell, for re-election to the U.S. Senate and said Republicans have botched the national government. Interest groups, including one supported by the governor herself, spent over $2 million to support or oppose the three sitting judges: Gary Alexander, Tom Chambers, and Susan Owens. Gregoire said she's looking into the idea of public financing, such as Arizona uses for judicial races. The Public Disclosure Commission is also looking into possible ways to curb the influence of independent groups.
West of Eugene this fall, workers are recreating natural habitat that hasn't been seen for decades. They're using bulldozers and eventually planting native vegetation to restore the floodplain along the stretch of the Coast Fork of the Willamette River in the Howard Buford Recreation Area. In the early last century, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers built rock levees to protect agricultural land from seasonal flooding. Now that is being reversed. Sponsors of the project say it will create new habitat for wildlife such as salmon, western palm turtles, and red-legged frogs. The current work will create a 5-acre backwater in the park's 200-acre South Meadow. It's part of a multi-year project. Funds for the work come from state agencies and donors, and some of the work is being done by volunteers.
A 75-year-old rendering business will close at the end of October, which will give Central Oregonians a problem disposing of animal carcasses. Martha Cacho and family members have owned the Redmond Tallow Company plant since 1970. But they say keeping the plant running is more trouble than it's worth. Neighbors have complained about the smell. The plant northeast of Redmond cooks meat scraps, restaurant grease, and livestock carcasses in giant pressure cookers to produce a substance used to make chicken, hog, and pet food. In 2001, the State Department of Environmental Quality suspected that nitrates from the carcasses were leaching into groundwater. Scott Cooper is head of the Crook County Commission. He says rendering plants are nasty, smelly, and unpleasant, but absolutely essential part of any economy that includes animals.
The State Department of Environmental Quality has asked Governor Ted Kulongoski to support a grant program that would encourage homeowners to replace older wood stoves with newer models that pollute less. The grants would provide money toward stoves that consume about two-thirds less wood and emit half as much smoke. The DEQ also asked the governor to back legislation that would require replacement of non-certified wood stoves when a home is sold. Klamath Falls, Oak Ridge, Medford, and Eugene Springfield either violate the limits or are close to violating them. Oak Ridge, which has no natural gas service, most seriously violates the new standards. DEQ says about 94,000 homes in Oregon would burn wood for heat.
Eugene scholar Dr. Alder Fuller is presenting workshops in the Southern Willamette Valley titled Global Warming and Climate Change, What Al Gore Is Not Telling You. Amy Merwin spoke with Fuller for the Eugene Report.
Alder Fuller, who is the founder of Ugalina Education and Prototista, is sponsoring public presentations. The topic of global warming and climate change, What Al Gore Is Not Telling You.
There is strong mathematical foundations behind complexity, but it turns out that the concepts involved in complexity are bearing up ideas that we intuited in our daily living experience even before complexity came along. Complexity is known to be representing scientifically many small components of ancient wisdom. For example, there's a great little principle called sensitive dependence. In everyday thinking, we would refer to that as the straw that broke the camel's back. One tiny little change in a system causes the system to collapse. In another version of it, we can call it phase transition at a critical threshold. Phase transition at a critical threshold is the way complexity looks at it. So what complexity is doing is taking these sort of almost commonly understood ideas that modern science for the last 200 or 300 years basically ignored and formalizing them as a science.
This leads us to your next presentations. Have we waited too long to address global warming? Have we reached that straw that breaks camel's back, especially with the news just in the last couple of weeks that there's an open passageway in parts of the Arctic Circle now for navigation, in addition that the areas in Siberia are letting out gases that have been trapped there under a frozen tundra for thousands of years, and that could speed up global warming because they are actually greenhouse gases that are being released.
That's an excellent summary of the problem that we're facing, to which the only thing that I would add would be the concept of a lag time. That is, even if we stop producing all greenhouse gas emissions tomorrow, we're still committed to heating for another several decades, as much as 100 years. That leads one to strongly consider the position that an increasing number of climate scientists are advancing, and that is that we have passed that tipping point, that we may well have already passed that point of the straw breaking the camel's back, that we may be committed now to global warming regardless of what we do. Now, having said that, I'm still firmly in the camp that believes that we need a two-pronged approach to this issue. Number one, do everything that we possibly can to slow it down. But number two, we'd also be equally foolish not to put in an equal amount of time to preparing for what do we do about this if we can't slow it down or stop it. How do we live our lives in a vastly changed world with a radically different planet than what we've experienced for the last 2,000 years.
Are you going to be having some answers for people, or will that be part of the discussion after your presentation?
I will be offering a few of my own opinions about what we should do. My main goal with these presentations and with my climate change class, which, by the way, I'll teach starting on Thursday, October 5th. I have goals. Number one, to help people understand what the issues are. What are global warming, or global heating, as I prefer to call it, and climate change? Number two, what's the evidence for past climate changes? What have they looked at, particularly with attention to how rapidly do they occur? And the short answer to that is very, very quickly, within a decade, quite often. And number three, what do we do about it?
And so people want to learn more about the classes that you offer. How would they do that?
Go to the website, prototista.org.
If people want to learn more about what they can do to address the issues of global warming, I would refer people to relocalize.net and also postcarbon.org. This is Amy Merwin.
NISA school officials defended a 7th grade social studies unit on Islam that included students dressing up in traditional Islamic dress. But one parent, Kinley Gardner, said she was upset at the 4 weeks spent on the unit on Islam as too long. And she also told the Ontario Argus Observer that she objected to the wearing of religious garb and the lack of parental notification, saying, quote, "I'm sure people would be outraged if they dressed up as the Pope," unquote. She said her son told her about the activity, and when she objected, he got an alternate assignment in the library. NISA School District Superintendent Don Grotting said the school has taught similar units as part of the meeting the state standards that call for students to, quote, "understand the importance of the rise of Islam and its interaction with Europe," unquote. School officials said that teaching about Islam is not promoting the religion.
Police say a man shot to death by a police officer in Vancouver had a toy gun. The man pointed it at the officer, who responded to a report yesterday of an unwanted person behind a Walmart. The officer fired one shot, killing the man. He was identified as a 62-year-old Douglas Damon, who was homeless. Police spokeswoman Kim Kapp says the officer, who was not hurt, is a veteran, now on leave for the shooting investigation.
The Supreme Court is scheduled to hear a series of cases affecting the business sector, including two with Oregon ties. In the first, Philip Morris is fighting an $80 million punitive damage award to the widow of Jesse Williams. He was a Portland janitor who died from lung cancer after smoking two packs of Marlboros a day. And in the other case, the Bush administration wants the justices to reverse a verdict against a lumber industry giant Weyerhaeuser in a lawsuit brought by a smaller competitor. A Portland jury awarded more than $26 million after deciding Weyerhaeuser used its market dominance to hoard alder saw logs. That sum was automatically tripled under federal antitrust law.
Bonneville Power Administration is cutting wholesale power rates for the fourth straight year. The rate cut announced today amounts to about 3%, a reduction that Bonneville credits mostly to a couple of new deals with its customers. The federal marketing agency based in Portland sells power to about 140 utilities in the Pacific Northwest from federal dams and a nuclear plant. Many of the utilities have agreed to let BPA to raise or reduce the monthly rate on short notice to reduce the cash that Bonneville had to keep in reserve. The BPA also said better-than-expected sales of surplus power helped trim wholesale rates.
A Sacramento-based company will grow and process genetically modified rice crop at a proposed plant in Kansas under plans announced yesterday. Venturia Bioscience has faced opposition elsewhere, but Kansas officials are embracing the California-based company. Venturia plans to use genetically altered rice to grow for manufacturing medicine, including one developed to fight childhood diarrhea. The company plans to spend $6 million to renovate an abandoned grocery distribution center and hopes farmers under contract will begin planting rice this spring. Eventually, Venturia could handle 50 workers at its plant and contract to grow 30,000 acres of this genetically modified rice.
Despite the recent E. coli spinach outbreak, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported Friday that food in general is safer now than at any other time in the last decade, with illnesses occurring at record low rates. Consumers get part of the credit for handling food more safely at home, but experts say the biggest improvement came from better industry controls and inspections. However, the trend could reverse in coming years if fruit and vegetable growers do not address problems such as those that led to the spinach scare. The CDC estimates germs in food make 76 million Americans ill, send over 300,000 to hospitals, and kill 5,000 each year. But the situation greatly improved over the past decade, according to illness statistics the agency reported Friday at a conference of the American Society for Microbiology. Only Vibrio, a germ spread through raw oysters, rose significantly, 41%.
Walmart has become the top corporate political spender. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, Walmart has spent $1.25 million so far in the 2006 election cycle. That's up from $325,000 in 2000, $430,000 in 2002, and $850,000 in 2004. Walmart spent the maximum allowable on a California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. And last year, Walmart spent $100,000 on Citizens to Save California, a committee created by Schwarzenegger's business supporters. Walmart also spent another $100,000 to defeat Proposition 77, a redistricting attempt that was the governor's pet measure. In addition, the company has given $300,000 to the state GOP and additional funds to local politicians, making California's the biggest recipient of Walmart's political largesse. And in the past 2 years, Schwarzenegger has vetoed two bills that Walmart opposed. One would have banned Walmart's practice of locking in cleaning crews after hours, and the other requiring disclosing employees receiving public-funded health care.
The Supreme Court sided today with Detroit newspaper unions and employees who were fired for their actions during an 18-month strike in the mid-1990s. Justices declined to hear the newspaper's appeal of a National Labor Relations Board ruling ordering the partnership that prints, distributes, and sells advertising for the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press to reinstate fired employees. The workers lost their jobs after the newspaper said they blocked entrances at a distribution facility and the Detroit News building in violation of court orders during the strike that ran from July 1995 to February 1997. The Labor Relations Board determined that employees had not engaged in misconduct, but were instead exercising their right to strike. It ordered the employees reinstated with back pay. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia upheld the board's ruling.
President Bush's two appointees to the U.S. Supreme Court will have a chance to shift the law to the right on two hot-button issues this year, abortion and race. As the court opens its October term today, Jan Meziere takes a look at the court's docket.
This coming session will review how Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Samuel Alito, both nominated by President Bush, rule on the nation's most divisive issue, women's rights to an abortion. The court will decide whether it is constitutional for the federal government to ban a second trimester surgical procedure, which is labeled the partial birth abortion by abortion foes. 6 years ago, the court struck down a Nebraska statute with similar language. Talcott Kemp is the deputy director of ACLU's Reproductive Freedom Project. She believes the federal ban will be nullified, just as the sunken Nebraska statute.
Number one, they use broad terminology that affects abortion procedures used throughout the second trimester of pregnancy from as early as 12 weeks, safe procedures that women need to protect their health. Number two, in both cases, both the Nebraska law and this federal law have no exception to protect women's health.
The courts will also rule on whether school boards can assign students based on their ethnicities to maintain diversity in the classroom. In 2003, the court ruled that affirmative action was allowed at the graduate level, but not the undergraduate level. Previous decisions on both abortion and affirmative action split the court 5-4. Retired Justice Sandra Day O'Connor served as the swing vote, ruling in favor of both. Now Justice Alito has replaced O'Connor, and Justice Roberts has taken the place vacated by late Chief Justice William Rehnquist. Professor Charles Abernathy studies constitutional law at Georgetown University. He says, although Justice Roberts and Justice Alito are more conservative than O'Connor, they may not rule accordingly.
Every justice is always free to seek to overturn prior cases if that justice wants to. But there's still a strong tendency among justices to follow precedent. What we may find is that they would seek to distinguish a precedent, say that the current case is different from an older case, rather than overturn it outright.
The Supreme Court will also take up global warming for the first time. The contentious point is whether the federal government should regulate vehicle emissions. For Free Speech Radio News, Ye Meixie in Washington, D.C.
The mayor of New Orleans signed an order today requiring that large businesses use as many local and minority-owned firms as possible when they seek millions of dollars in tax incentives and grants for Hurricane Katrina recovery. Mayor Ray Nagin's executive order requires applicants for the incentives to involve 50% local businesses and 35% women or minority-controlled businesses whenever possible. A similar requirement has been in place for government contracts, but the mayor's order expands it to businesses applying for assistance promised by various federally funded recovery programs that are administered by the city and the state. Nagin said his order should help ensure that local firms enjoy the benefits of the enormous federal rebuilding investment and help them secure small business loans and other financing.
Over a year after Hurricane Katrina, the international relief group Oxfam has blasted officials effort to help those most in need. Oxfam says the benefits of Louisiana's, quote, Road Home, quote, program will bypass the neediest communities if nonprofits and faith-based groups aren't assigned a significant role in this distribution. The Road Home program should reimburse as much as $150,000 to homeowners and small landlords. But community groups say very few people have been compensated for their loss. Davida Finger, Louisiana State Coordinator for Oxfam's Gulf Coast Emergency Program, said that for 12 long months, it's been nonprofit and faith-based groups that have helped people, help the poor folks across coastal Louisiana, not the federal or state government.
Mary Bomar, a British native and career Interior Department employee, has been confirmed as director of the National Park Service. She succeeds Fran Manella. Bomar has worked at the Park Service for 17 years and has been the Park Service's Northeast Regional Director since 2005. She takes over as the Park Service is struggling with a backlog of maintenance and rehabilitation projects. Critics have complained that the Bush administration has favored recreation interests at the expense of conservation, though the agency has recently retreated from some of its most controversial plans. Manella this summer rejected a management proposal that critics said would have expanded the use of snowmobiles and all-terrain vehicles on federal land. Instead, she signed a policy emphasizing that conservation is the park's first responsibility.
The resignation of Florida Republican Mark Foley over explicit internet messages to minors has led to outrage on Capitol Hill. The Republican leadership is attempting to defend their role in what Democrats are calling a cover-up of inappropriate activity. Meanwhile, the former congressman has checked himself into rehab. Washington editor for FSRN Lee Ann Caldwell reports.
Mark Foley, the ex-congressman, has checked himself into a rehabilitation clinic citing alcohol abuse and emotional problems. The founder of the Congressional Caucus on Missing and Exploited Children resigned Friday night after ABC News revealed he sent sexually explicit instant messages to high school-aged teens who work on the floors of the House and the Senate in the Congressional Page program. Already, Foley's congressional website is down, and official documentation of the House of Representatives says Florida's 16th congressional district is vacant, as if Mark Foley never existed. But the talk on Capitol Hill would suggest otherwise. The FBI and the Department of Justice are involved, as is the White House and the state of Florida. And members of the former representative's own party are at the center of the storm. Just one day after leaving town for campaign season, House Speaker Dennis Hassert flew back to Washington to turn damage control in high gear. In a carefully worded press conference, Speaker Hassert was joined by Chair of the Page Program, Representative John Shimkus. House Speaker Hassert again denies any knowledge of Foley's wrongdoing.
No one in the Republican leadership, nor Congressman Shimkus, saw those messages until last Friday when ABC News released them to the public. When they were released, Congressman Foley resigned, and I'm glad he did. If he had not, I would have demanded his expulsion from the House of Representatives.
But top Democrats don't buy it, and they want the Ethics Committee to investigate Republican leadership for hiding such information. Democratic Representative John Murtha of Pennsylvania.
I don't know what they saw, but it's really makes me nervous that they look like they tried to cover it up.
To bolster Democrats' claims is a statement made by Representative Rodney Alexander, Republican from Louisiana, who represented the page who received the emails. Alexander said in a statement over the weekend that he told Speaker Hassert of the communication that Foley sent to the teen. But But Speaker Hassert was tight-lipped, taking no questions from the press after he expressed his ignorance on the matter.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Instead, he offered statements that would free him of any guilt by association. He also assured parents their children are safe working for Congress.
After all, this vile instant messaging exchange reportedly took place after the page had returned home. Moms and dads all across America know what a challenge it is to monitor contacts with their kids in this new world of instant communications in cyberspace. It's our challenge as well.
Hassert asked the Department of Justice to begin an investigation into the expanse of emails and instant messages sent to minors. The FBI began their investigation yesterday. Hassert also sent a letter to Florida Governor Jeb Bush and set up a hotline for pages to call with their concerns. But this scandal is yet another blow to embattled Republicans 5 weeks before Election Day, where they are trying to hold on to congressional majority. Foley represents a deep-rooted Republican district in which voters must choose between Foley or his Democratic opponent, Tim Mahoney. That's a seat that was originally thought of as a long shot for Democrats. Larry Sabato, political scientist at the University of Virginia, says this could greatly impact all Republicans on Election Day.
We're going to have an investigation over the next couple of weeks, maybe longer, asking who knew and when did they know it in the Republican leadership.
In order for Democrats to regain control of Congress, they must pick up 15 seats in the House and 6 in the Senate. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
The Northern Boreal Forest in the Alaska, Canada, and Russia provide at least $250 billion a year in ecosystem services like reducing atmospheric carbon and water filtration. Economist Mark Anielski said governments need to begin accounting for those services before selling it off to timber, oil drilling, and mining companies. He presented his findings at Canada's 10th National Forest Congress last week. Anielski says the boreal forest is like a giant carbon bank account. The forests and peatlands store an estimated 67 billion tons of carbon in Canada alone. That's almost 8 times the amount of carbon produced worldwide in the year 2000. However, new satellite pictures show massive clear-cutting of the forest in Ontario. Despite official Canadian commitment to sustainable forestry, photos show huge holes in the forest where nothing is left but rocks and broken tree limbs. Ontario allows clear-cutting areas 15 times as large as Russia, which is home to the majority of the boreal forest. In the U.S., the Pew Center on Global Climate Change estimates there's 115 million acres of land that is poor for agriculture but good for growing trees. Switching that land to forests could store enough carbon to cut U.S. emissions by nearly 20%.
Democracy Now! Reported that the 9/11 Commission members have expressed alarm over the report in Bob Woodward's new book that Condoleezza Rice brushed off warnings from bin Laden in July 2001. According to Woodward, the previously unknown meeting 2 months before the September 11th attacks between the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, former CIA Director George Tenet, and his counterterrorism head, Clifford Black, went over top secret intelligence, pointing to an impending attack. Woodward writes that Tenet and Black felt that Rice brushed off their concerns. The White House has disputed Woodward's account of the meeting.
The current time is 5:33. And now, time for another Rootin' Tootin' Daily Commentary from Jim Hightower.
George W. called it a great example, declaring that our country should take some lessons from it. The it that has so enamored George is the privatized Social Security system that was imposed on the people of Chile 25 years ago by the dictatorship of Augusto Pinochet. His system of having workers pay into personal pension accounts managed by private investment banks is called the Chilean model, and it has long been hailed by laissez-faire think tanks and by the Bushites as a model for privatizing our own nation's Social Security program. Before we swallow this pill of privatization, however, we might want to ask the people of Chile how they have fared under its marketplace magic. Not well. Chilean workers who participate have 10% of their paychecks deducted and put into the hands of the private pension bankers. Yet half of the Chilean people cannot afford this deduction, so they end up with no old age pension whatsoever. Of those who do participate, the rules are so rigged that 40% cannot accumulate enough money in the system to have a livable retirement. As a top official of the Economic Commission for Latin America bluntly puts it, the bottom line is that this system does not work. Well, it might not work for the people, but it's working very nicely for the bankers. The six funds now running the privatized system are enjoying an average annual profit of 50%. The reason for such astonishing profits is, of course, the same reason that U.S. banks are riding high: exorbitant fees. The World Bank finds that Chilean pension managers are ripping off between a fourth and a third of the workers' payments in the form of commissions and other fees. Compare that to our own Social Security system, which takes only 1% for administrative costs and covers everyone. This is Jim Hightower saying, Bush is right. We can take some lessons from the Chilean model. Lesson number one is forget it.
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
Stay tuned for Labor Radio at 6 p.m. at following this newscast. And at 7, it's Time Sound with Ken Berry. Tonight's weather in Portland and the Columbia Gorge should be partly cloudy with a slight chance of rain, a temperature of 40 to 5 to 50 degrees. Tomorrow, weather in Portland and the Columbia Gorge should be mostly cloudy with a chance of showers at around 65 degrees. You're listening to KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Palestine's Hamas-led administration has announced it is closing all government offices in the wake of violent clashes between supporters of Fatah and Hamas. Manar Jabrin reports.
Over the weekend, clashes in Gaza erupted between hundreds of Fatah-aligned police demanding back pay and Hamas-aligned executive forces. Similar fighting in the West Bank city of Nablus injured at least six, including the bodyguard of Deputy Prime Minister Nasreddin Shaar, who was seriously injured. A resident of the West Bank city of Jericho died today when a group of gunmen imposed commercial strike in the city. In the West Bank city of Ramallah yesterday, dozens of protesters set fire to the building that houses the offices of the Deputy Prime Minister. They also broke into the building of the Palestinian Legislative Council and destroyed its contents. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Prime Minister Ismail Haniyeh were scheduled to hold a meeting in Gaza on forming a national unity government before the violence began. They have appealed to both sides to stop fighting and withdrew from the streets. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibin.
This past Saturday, for the first time since we invaded Iraq, residents of Baghdad were banned from walking outside for an entire day. All motor vehicle traffic was also banned. Saturday's curfew was put in place after a bodyguard for a leading Sunni lawmaker was arrested on suspicion of planning bomb attacks inside the Green Zone. The bodyguard worked for the main Sunni Arab party in the Iraqi government. Leading Shiite lawmakers are now calling for a shakeup of the Iraqi cabinet to remove Sunni lawmakers with ties to the insurgents.
Up to 40 people were killed in clashes between rebel groups in South Darfur, forcing foreign aid workers to abandon the Greta displaced person camp. African Union spokesman in Khartoum confirmed a flare-up in fighting in Greta, but put the death toll at 11 people, mostly civilians. An estimated 130,000 people displaced by the conflict in Darfur live in the camp beside Greta. The United Nations said it had unconfirmed reports that the situation was worsening in Greta, and that heavy shooting there reported last week was the result of a tribal conflict.
Municipal governments in South Africa's major cities are expressing a desire to want to move up become world-class cities. Those aspirations often result in removal of large numbers of people from common spaces. Cape Town City Council is now in the process of rewriting bylaws regulating public spaces. FSRN's Turna Giose reports from the opposition from the streets.
And the people are not working unemployed.
The government is looking up to the people who have cars, houses like that. Don't look at people who don't have food every day.
I don't have a right.
about 5th March to Cape Town Civic Center to demand that a new bylaw that limits access to streets be changed or dropped. They object to sections of the proposed best streets, public places, and the mentioned public news bylaw that would ban a range of activities from public places, including car washing, vending without a license, spitting, skating, or simply touching someone's property without their consent.
We are beginning to see bylaws and policies that are beginning to drive people away from areas that are...
Simpiwe Dada from the Alternative Information and Development Center says that unemployment in South Africa is as high as 40%, while social support for the unemployed is minimal. The street is the only place that many people have to make a living or a home for themselves.
So therefore, if this bylaw is go through and enforced, it's going to reduce people's ability to survive.
This bylaw is only a consolidation of 50 or more existing regulations, according to Jean-Pierre Smith, city councillor responsible for the safety portfolio. He says the city's intent is to bring order to practices like car washing and hawking, as well as to crack down on what's termed aggressive begging. He says there has been extensive consultation with street people and their support organizations over several years. The bylaw has been endorsed by the Central Street People's Federation, a group of 25 NGOs that works with people in the street. Councillor Smith says that the current campaign against the law is politically motivated.
So again, all you get from them is sweeping and broad rhetoric. That leads me to believe that the emphasis is not on actually achieving for them a more meaningful bylaw, but on prolonging the point scoring as long as possible.
Patrick Solomons, a leading voice of the NGO task force opposing the bylaw, rejects the accusation.
We do feel that the bylaw is problematic, that it is unconstitutional, it violates people's rights to movement and expression. We also feel that the bylaw specifically targets poor and homeless people.
Hannes van der Merwe works with a group called Stratwerk, which helps street people find permanent employment. He is generally supportive of the new bill.
Yeah, it does depend on the people who try to implement the law, but it has changed. And I'm confident that we're moving in a better direction. We're not moving in a worse direction.
Rosa, a street kid at the march, doesn't share Van der Merwe's optimism.
And sometimes they can pick us up just for standing and talking with somebody because we just talk with a person and we're dirty. But if other people sit there, it's clean, then they don't care about dead people, they don't chase dead people away. They can even smack you and hit you, but it's a man, you see. They search the ladies out and it's a man, which means they are touching us where we don't want to be touched, which is also wrong.
Her picket sign compares the new bylaw to the old laws that banned black people from whites-only areas. If racial discrimination in South Africa's cities is history, then class discrimination continues to be reinforced.
But we just want other people to respect us for who we are and not to discriminate us, especially the cops and the securities, because while we also is just trying to make a living for ourselves on the streets.
Standing outside City Hall, Nicolas Vertboy, homeless for 29 years, summarizes the demands of people living and working on the street.
I'm a human like anybody. If people can come and get us off the street, giving us jobs, we are willing to do it. But nobody attend to us. So that is the reason why we're on the street. So we need help.
For Free Speech Radio News, I am Taylor Guse in Cape Town.
Election is to go. Brazil's presidential election is to go to a runoff after President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva failed to win outright in the first round. Lula fell about 1% short of the 50% needed to avoid a runoff. He will stand against former Sao Paulo governor Geraldo Alckmin, who took 41.4% of the vote. Alckmin gained ground in the campaign after last-minute allegations of corruption against President Lula's party.
Thousands of Haitians took to the streets Saturday to mark the 15th anniversary of the coup d'etat that ousted former President Jean-Bertrand Aristide and to demand his return to the country. Aristide was removed from power for a second time 2 years ago when the U.S. Marines whisked him away into exile in South Africa, but he remains popular in Haiti. Katie Sosin reports from Port-au-Prince.
Odilia Esperance has paid dearly for her support of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. In the wake of the 1991 coup d'etat, Esperance was nearly killed when she was intentionally hit by a car after attending a pro-Aristide meeting. After Aristide was ousted for a second time in 2004, Her son was imprisoned in what she believes was a politically motivated detention. He remains in jail. Esperance joined the demonstration Saturday to demand Haitian President René Préval bring back Aristide and give justice to victims of the two regime changes. I'm asking for justice because poor people can no longer support these things. Today, our sons and daughters can't go to school, but if Mr. Aristide were here, they would have had the opportunity to go. September 30th means that we have a lot of victims now. And we think that President Préval is going to bring us justice, because this is why we elected him. 15 years after the army toppled this nation's first democratically elected leader, Aristide is still the icon of democracy for many Haitians. Préval was prime minister during the 91 coup, and he was elected last February, in large part due to support from Aristide backers. Now, many of them expect Préval to bring Aristide back to Haiti. So far, Préval has dodged the issue, and the potential homecoming of the controversial exiled leader looms as a political landmine for the Haitian president. Protesters gathered near the charred skeleton of St. John Bosco Church, the birthplace of Aristide's movement that was burned down by army thugs in 1988. Under a searing sun, demonstrators walked, jogged, and ran for miles through pro-Aristide strongholds like Cité Soleil and Bel Air. 2 years ago, the September 30th demonstration unleashed a wave of violence between the police of Haiti's then-interim government and Aristide supporters. But on Sunday, the protest was peaceful, and demonstrators gave high fives to police officers. The demonstration ended without incidents in the capital's downtown, where police blocked protesters from continuing on to the National Palace. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Katie Sasson, Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
The political situation in Oaxaca, Mexico, has gone from tense to worse with the start of military aircraft flights over the capital city this weekend. This morning, a previously unknown guerrilla group claimed responsibility for setting off improvised explosives at three different banks in Oaxaca City. Members of the popular movement in Oaxaca were quick to distance themselves from the explosions and warned that the bank attacks could provide the pretext for a major military operation. Shannon Young reports from Oaxaca City.
Members of the popular movement demanding the resignation of Oaxaca's Governor Ulises Ruiz declared a maximum alert after military helicopters and a reconnaissance airplane began flying over Oaxaca City on Saturday afternoon. The large helicopters are the same model used by the Mexican Marines. The overflights continued over the weekend and into the early morning hours of today. Newspaper reports have documented the arrival of troops, tanks, and combat helicopters in the Oaxacan ports of Salina Cruz and Huatulco. Although it is very rare to see helicopters in the skies over Oaxaca, Mexico's Interior Secretary, Carlos Abascal, played down the overflights, saying that they were just routine supply runs. But many residents of this city view the low overflights of military aircraft as an attempt to intimidate the protesters who have brought business as usual in this colonial tourist town to a standstill for more than 4 months. Flavio Sosa, one of the leaders of the Popular Assembly of the People of Oaxaca, spoke at an improvised press conference shortly after the first overflights on Saturday afternoon.
It's an open provocation on the part of the federal government. Vicente Fox is responsible for what happens in Oaxaca. We said just yesterday that we are willing to stay at the negotiating table. We don't want to understand that the helicopters or the armed forces are the response sent to the people of Oaxaca.
The federal government has called leaders of the social movement and the teachers union to a negotiating session scheduled for Wednesday. Also invited are business leaders, civil society representatives, and Governor Ulises Ruiz. In statements made today, President Fox warned of, quote, punishments if an agreement is not reached. Spokesman of the Oaxacan Teachers Union, Daniel Rosas, says this is indicative of a coming massive repression.
For us, this is a very clear message that this is to hit us hard, that this is the beginning of the repression. But this has also strengthened the citizenry so that we are on the extreme alert, given that at any moment these men can send in repressive forces.
Despite the military overflights, many of the estimated 2,000 barricades installed throughout the city have been reinforced in light of the possible operations to remove protesters blockading or occupying government offices, town halls, radio stations, and the central square of Oaxaca City. Members of the popular movement known as APO held a general assembly meeting over the weekend with delegations from throughout the state. According to the resolutions read by this APO member at the conclusion of the statewide assembly meeting, the movement in Oaxaca will try to expand to a national level.
Se está convocando a partir de este momento a la instalación de la asamblea.
As of this moment, we are calling for the creation of a popular assembly of the people of Mexico. We announced that on the 13th of October, we will launch a caravan called All of Mexico in Support of Oaxaca.
Marcha caravana, todo México en apoyo a Oaxaca.
This afternoon, student organizations and members of the popular movement will march to commemorate the 38th anniversary of the Tlatelolco massacre. Although marches throughout Mexico every year commemorate the 1968 student massacre by Mexico's armed forces, the context of the political situation in Oaxaca, coupled with the recent appearance of military forces and the warnings from President Fox, make this year's massacre anniversary something very different here. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shannon Young with Vladimir Flores in Oaxaca City.
Indian economy is the second fastest growing in the world after China. To attract foreign investment, the Indian government has created more than 100 special economic zones, forcefully acquiring agriculture land worth billions of dollars for throwaway prices. Vinod K. Joes reports.
These tractors in the farmland are to stop working soon. 8,000 hectares of prime agricultural land, just 40 miles from Delhi, is purchased for a special economic zone, or SEZ. Over 100 such SEZs are on its way in different parts of the country. Sadish Singh in Hasru village lost all his land. The Indian government bought it for a throwaway price, only to hand it over to a private company.
Loan was being taken from us forcefully. We had to get satisfied with whatever they paid us. Now we are left with no loan to do farming.
Minister for Commerce Kamal Nath wants investments to increase.
We must remember one thing, one basic thing, that we want industry to come in, yes or no. If we want industry to come in, that industry cannot come in the air or in the ocean. It should come on the ground.
The minister is confident the SEZs will attract $20 billion of investment in the next 3 years alone. But many consider such investments to be at the cost of India's social security. Paranjoy Gukhatakurta is a senior business journalist.
We pride ourselves on being a democracy. You're going to create little enclaves of our affluence within the country where your labor laws won't apply, your environment laws won't apply. We'll have urban townships with populations running into millions. Well, they'll have no democratic process of election of local government. You'll have private monopolies providing your utilities, whether it be water, electricity. You know, it is the greatest land grab in the history of modern India.
National corporations are invited to special economic zones with huge tax reductions. Vandana Shiva is an ecologist and activist.
Something like $2 trillion of taxes are going to be sacrificed. India might be rich when it comes to 8.5% growth, but India is extremely poor when you look at how many people are going hungry, how many anti-poverty measures this country needs, how healthcare is not reaching people. There's something very amiss, and we don't have the luxury to give tax holidays and tax breaks. America is being created within the poverty of India, and the poor have been displaced. You will see crime. You will see a huge increase in social instability.
Mass protests by farmers forced the Indian government to slow down on the matter, at least for the time being. Prime Minister Manmohan Singh calls special economic zones a main agenda of his government. But farmers call it sophisticated land grabbing. For FSRN from New Delhi, this is Vinod Jules.
Baghdad has emerged from a three-day-long curfew, but violence continues to escalate. There have been at least 19 deaths in bombings and shootings today. 14 workers had been kidnapped from computer shops. Iraqi police say they found at least 50 bodies in the past 24 hours, many of them from a group of 24 food processing workers kidnapped yesterday. The continuing violence has prompted Iraq's parliament to extend the government's emergency powers to impose martial law.
In the Zambian capital of Lusaka, business remained closed today after a night of widespread looting. Police are firing tear gas for the second day running in most townships around the capital.
We'll get back to that story later if we get a chance. In Argentina, over 50,000 prisoners are participating in a hunger strike to demand reforms of the country's sentencing rules. As the strike enters its 10th day, supporters of prisoners are raising concerns about their health. FSRN's Marie Trigona has more from Buenos Aires.
Prisoners began the hunger strike to demand that courts overturn a penal code which counts only half of each day spent in jail while waiting for trial toward a prisoner's sentence after conviction. The hunger-striking prisoners report that hundreds are still in jail after completing their sentences. They are now more than 10 days into their strike. A human rights group in Argentina has filed a habeas corpus petition for prisoners on strike in the Buenos Aires province. The Committee Against Torture is pressing state penitentiary officials to provide adequate health care for them. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
Amid dropping oil prices, OPEC members Nigeria and Venezuela have announced a cut in their crude oil exports. Sam Alukoya reports from Lagos.
Nigeria, the world's sixth largest oil exporter, says it will reduce its export by 5%, while Venezuela announced a cut of 50,000 barrels per day. International oil prices recently reached a six-month low. Both countries are believed to have cut their oil exports in a bid to increase oil prices. Iran, another OPEC member, says it will support any move by OPEC members to increase oil prices, raising the possibility it could cut its own output as well. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Ulukoya in Lagos.
China state media says 1.4 million people will be displaced by the government's Three Gorges Dam project, nearly 300,000 more than predicted. The Xinhua news agency said the number of people already relocated has reached 1.3 million. The dam in central China, Hubei province, is the world's biggest hydropower project and will go into full operation in 2008. The project has come under fire from environmental and social critics.
Hundreds of people in northern Nigeria have been made homeless after a dam burst in Zamfara state following torrential rains. The state governor said about 1,000 families had lost their homes after the dam collapsed on Saturday. He said, contrary to reports by local media, that no one was killed. Emergency repairs to the dam are expected to take about 2 weeks.
Sudan's government has signed a wealth-sharing deal with rebels in the country's east. The move follows ceasefire agreement made between the Eastern Front Rebel Coalition and the government in June. During almost 10 years of low-scale conflict, the Eastern Front Rebel Coalition have accused the government of exploiting their natural resources without developing the region. Despite being rich in natural resources, the East remains one of the country's most impoverished regions.
And that's the KBOO Evening News for Monday, October 2nd. Sorry, we had some technical difficulties with that one story, so goodbye. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. That goes for news tips as well. Call us at 503-231-8032, extension 203. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Mike Mungfold. Our assistant producer is Ross Egan. Our AP Wire editor is Brendan Wright. Tonight's audio editor is Mike Mungfold. Special thanks to reporters Rachel Bell, Amy Merwin, and Brendan Wright. Our engineer is Jeff Lovell. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Lisa Lewis.
And I'm Andy Seaton. Coming up on tomorrow morning on KBOO, At 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Joe Uris and Abe Proctor host the Abe and Joe Talk Show. At 9, on Between the Covers, host Ed Goldberg interviews Andrew Vash, the author of Two Trains Running, a historical novel of social change in 1959. And at 9:30 on Black Book Talk, guest is Jacqueline Woodson, award-winning author of Hush, Locomotion, and The Miracle Boys. And at 10:30 on Stage and Studio, guest Emily Young speaks with folks from the Imago Theater about Howard Pinter's play, The Betrayal. And at 11 o'clock, Thank God It's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, listener-sponsored community radio station. Volunteer with our broadcast team by calling 503-231-8032 or at extension 203, or come by the Galaxy in a half an hour and share a beer with the anchor crew. Thanks for joining us.
Subvert KBOO's upcoming membership drive by renewing your membership in our fall sweepstakes, where you could be the lucky winner of a $2,000 shopping spree all around Portland. KBOO is offering $200 gift certificates from 10 local businesses as the sweepstakes prize. These businesses include Bike Central Co-op, Buffalo Gardens, Cotton Cloud Futons and Furniture, Higgins Restaurant and Bar, Mirador Community Store, Oregon Mountain Community, Portland Saturday Market, The Rebuilding Center, Spa Wilhelmina, and Susan Hebert Imports. If you're a KBOO member, you should have already received your entry form in the mail. Entering KBOO's fall sweepstakes is easy, but you can't win if you don't enter. To enter, simply mail back your reply card to KBOO so that we receive it before 5 p.m. local time on Friday, October 13th. We'll announce the winner on air Saturday, October 14th at noon. If you're a KBOO member and haven't received your sweepstakes entry form yet, please contact KBOO's membership department at 503-231-8032, extension 207, or send an email to membership@kboo.org.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344. And also by AFSCME Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.ws.
Good evening. Welcome to Labor Radio, the only program of its kind in Oregon and Southwest Washington. I'm your host, Bill Zimmerman, Teamsters Local 206. In 1988, the U.S. Justice Department filed a civil racketeering suit seeking to oust the Teamsters' national president and his executive board because of links to organized crime. The move ushered in a new era at the Teamsters Union and gave the rank and file increased power and the right to elect top union officers. Earlier this week, for the fifth time, all 1.4 million members of the Teamsters Union will receive ballots in the mail. The union represents, to name a few, truckers, warehouse, nurses, UPS, police officers, and because of recent mergers, rail and graphic communications workers. What's at stake for the Teamster members, the labor movement, and workers outside the union in this election? And will the Teamsters Union return to the reform movement of the 90s to empower rank-and-file members, or will it continue the backward slide to yesteryear, when labor bosses negotiated contracts in smoke-filled back rooms? Both candidates to the top position in the Teamsters Union have been invited to tonight's program. Tom Leadham, a 29-year Teamster, started as a warehouse worker and within a few years was elected as principal officer of Local 206, then went on to become director of the warehouse division overseeing 400,000 Teamster members, then elected as international vice president, has accepted tonight's invitation. James P. Hoffa, a 25-year corporate lawyer and son of Jimmy Hoffa, was ruled ineligible in the 1991 national election because he could not show 2 years of membership, went on to lose the 96 election, and finally was elected in 1998 and still serves as president. Today, the Teamsters Union is rocked with pension cuts, health and welfare cuts, weak contracts, and even weaker grievance panels. James P. Hoffa has yet to accept tonight's invitation. I'd say time is running out. Now, if you detect a note of bias in my voice, I plead guilty. It's just as an active Teamster for over 20 years, I know the difference between PR and true Teamster power. Later on tonight's program, we'll be talking to Ken Path, National Organizer of Teamsters for Democratic Union, and we'll also be talking to C Block about an upcoming event. But first, tonight on Labor Radio is Tom Leadham, international candidate for the top position in the Teamsters Union. Tom, welcome back to Labor Radio.
Hey, thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, at least we have one of the candidates here. I'm still hoping that Hoffa will call in sometime tonight. Tom, I know you've been on the campaign trail. What are Teamster members saying to you about the current state of the union?
Well, I've been campaigning the last couple of days in Boston, and I tell you, the response here has been fantastic. Teamsters really want change. They want a stronger union. They want an honest union, and the response we're getting at the gates has really been tremendous. We've been out campaigning with rank-and-file Teamster members, and they're talking about a number of issues. I mean, they're talking about strengthening their contracts, and they're talking about ways to solve the pension problems in their union. And so I got to tell you, I'm really just gratified by the level of interest in the election this time around.
The cuts to the Central States Pension Fund and the West Pension Fund have pushed that issue to the center of the campaign. What's your take on the cuts and what can be done?
Well, you know, I think it's remarkable because on the one hand, in the central states, the trustees are indicating that they had to make the cuts because of underfunding of the plan. Yet in the West, the plan is fully funded, and yet Teamster members have suffered a 60% reduction in their accrual rate, which translates for a normal freight Teamster that since the cuts were implemented, he or she has probably lost about $500 a month out of their pension check for the rest of their life. So what I think is really happening is the loss of control of our funds. We have Taft-Hartley funds, which mean that they have an equal number of union trustees and employer trustees. And I believe that the corporations are really dominating the decision-making on these funds.
You plan to change that when elected?
Absolutely. You know, it's the issue that you hear about most from Teamsters, and with good reason. I mean, they've worked very hard in very physically demanding jobs, and for many of them, the whole idea was to be able to retire while they were still healthy and while they could still, you know, enjoy life. And with the cuts in the pension benefit and the increased cost of health insurance, particularly for retirees, for many Teamsters, that that goal and that dream is all of a sudden unattainable. It's almost as if just as they got to that point where they could see the light at the end of the tunnel, the rules changed and the rug was pulled out from under them.
And what you're saying is there's no reason with a fund that's fully funded to have that happen.
I think particularly in the West where you have a fully funded pension plan, it doesn't make sense that that they would suffer these cuts. In addition to that, there's been recent legislation, a so-called multi-employer pension reform, which has made it even more difficult and I think has further eroded their confidence in these plans. So I think it depends on the plan that you're talking about. All these plans are different and they're administered in different ways, but clearly there's more going on than meets the eye in regard to these pension cuts. What I also find very interesting as I talk with Teamster members around the U.S. is the fact that workers in the East, for example, don't realize what's happening in the West and vice versa. I mean, we're the leadership has sort of kept the membership divided, and we really can't, you know, they don't really understand or get news of what's happening to their brothers and sisters in other parts of the country. And excuse me, we're trying to address that and really shine the light of day on these pension plans so that Teamsters understand how they're being affected in different parts of the country. And I think people are really, they're hungry for that information, and you know, they want to know how they can work together to address these concerns.
Tom, one of the other central issues in the campaign seems to center around organizing and freight. I know when Hoffa took over the union, about 30 overnight terminals, and for folks that don't know, Overnight is a nationwide trucking company, but about 30 overnight terminals were organized at that time. What has happened to the overnight organizing, and what do we do from this point?
Well, you're right. I mean, when Hoffa took office, we had actually organized 37 overnight terminals, and Overnight is one of the largest LTL trucking companies. And when I say LTL trucking, LTL freight is less than truckload freight. It's freight that requires large terminals where freight product is broken up, and trucks carrying that freight will deliver to many different companies, or they'll deliver to many different locations. So LTL freight requires a national system of terminals where they can break freight down and, you know, move it and consolidate various loads, because it's not full truckload. Truckload freight is where the entire truck is, you know, going to a specific location. And so there's a big difference in the two. And Overnight was one of the biggest non-union LTL carriers and competed with our Master Freight trucking companies, which is really the flagship, along with UPS, of our union. And 37 of those terminals had been organized in the mid-90s. And when Hoffa took office, he fired the organizers that were working on that campaign and essentially never organized another terminal. They waited several months, and then they took those 37 terminals workers out on strike. And that's 37 terminals out of 300. So the strike was really doomed from the beginning, because we just didn't have a nucleus big enough to win that strike, and the strike drug on for many years, over 3 years, in fact. And in 2001, I recall at the Teamster convention, Hoffa promised from the podium that he would win a contract at Overnight, and it was just a few months after the election when he was reelected that he just pulled the plug on the Overnight organizing. Now, since that time, I think it's been a really dramatic development. UPS bought Overnight here within the last year and relabeled it UPS Freight, which makes it a real threat to jobs both at UPS because it's a ready-made network of less than truckload that can siphon off work from Teamsters at UPS, but also it's a threat to our Teamsters working under the Master Freight Agreement because it's in direct competition with them. So it's a serious issue in our union, and it's one that Teamsters across the country are really paying attention to.
Right. And Tom, when elected, what do you plan on doing with, you know, you mentioned that UPS Freight is a threat to, of course, the UPS contract and the freight contract. I also believe that it's a threat to Teamsters as a whole, because when we begin that downward slide of a lesser contract in one of our core industries, it finds itself in, then becomes in warehouse and other industries that Teamsters represent. When elected, what do you plan on doing about the Overnight situation?
Well, we have to organize UPS Freight. I mean, there's just no question about it, and it's something that just has to be done. So many of the issues facing the Teamsters and facing labor in general is the lack of organization in the private sector. And many of these problems can be solved by increased organizing activity. For example, we talked about the pension funds, and the best way to deal with pensions that are underfunded, some are, is to organize our way out of this, to add new members to the funds, to get more members contributing through their employers into these funds. So it's a critical issue, and it's something that has to be done if we're going to turn around the decline in Teamster membership. Since Hoffa took office, we've lost 150,000 members in the Teamsters union. Now, you mentioned in your introduction that we've merged unions, and yes, we have merged some rail unions, and we're certainly glad to have them on board. We think that we should be the premier transportation union in the country, and we've also merged other unions like the GCIU, which is now the GCC, an affiliate of the Teamsters. So organizing would solve a lot of our problems, and what we would like to do and what I plan to do is to go back to the organizing programs and the organizing techniques, strategies, and tactics that really worked in the 90s when we were able to turn around a 16-year decline in Teamster membership. We began organizing again, and we did it in a very specific way. We took Teamsters off the job. And under many of our contracts, such as UPS and in Master Freight, we have the right to take Teamster members off the job under union leave, and we intend to use that language to take Teamsters off the job, train them to be organizers, and we're going to hire 1,000 organizers in that way, and we're going to train them and turn them loose on the non-union competition. And we're doing this to strengthen our pensions, to strengthen our benefit funds, but also to support our existing contracts. If we organize in specific industries where Teamsters represent workers now, we can protect their contracts, we can organize the non-union competition, and we can move everyone forward in that industry. And that's what we're really trying to do, and we want to concentrate on our core industries, specifically in freight and the non-union competition to UPS. That will help us organize in other industries such as warehousing and other forms of distribution. So we have a very specific plan to deal with this issue, and by dealing with the lack of organizing, by turning that around, we're going to solve a lot of other problems as well.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Tom Latham, a candidate for the national president of the Teamsters Union. I noticed the green light went on in the engineer room. I'm wondering if that could be Hoffa on the line, Ben? No, I guess not. Sorry, folks. I thought maybe Brother Hoffa would show up to this. Tom, one more question on freight, and then I want to move on. At the 2006 Teamster convention, Hoffa announced car check neutrality at UPS Freight. And for those that don't know, car check neutrality means that a union is free to organize its the workers, and a union will not interfere with that organizing effort. Now, it's my understanding that this was a very proud announcement for the Hoff administration. What has happened to that car check neutrality at UPS Freight?
Well, car check is important, and it's a tactic that many unions are using to organize and to avoid, in some cases, to avoid the NLRB election process, which can drag things out. It means that the company will take a neutral position and on the election and allow workers to make their own decision. So it's a very powerful way to organize and a good way to organize. I was at the 2006 convention, and he announced car check neutrality. And I have to tell you, I jumped to my feet, and I applauded the neutrality announcement. But as I was standing there clapping, I sort of thought to myself, well, you know, you might want to hear the details of this. And now, of course, the details have come out, and out of the 300 terminals, we were only allowed under the agreement to organize at one terminal out of 300. And I have to question if Hoffa could not get a contract when we had 37 terminals organized. I find it highly unlikely that he'll be able to achieve an agreement, an industry standard agreement, with only one terminal organized.
Absolutely. Tom, also, Hoffa promised not to increase dues. In 2002, without a vote of the membership, the largest dues increase ever happened to Teamster members, and again, without a vote of the membership. Under this was going for organizing and a strike fund. What has happened to that money?
Well, it's a good question. There were a lot of promises made in the last election, and unfortunately, none of them have been delivered on. One was that, that there wouldn't be a dues increase, and of course, we've had the biggest dues increase in history. He made his promises about overnight, which certainly did not come to pass. He's also told Teamsters that under their national agreements and UPS, Master Freight, car haul agreement, that there would be no benefit reductions, that their benefits were protected. And it was just a few months after those contracts were ratified that they announced these various pension cuts. So, there have been a lot of promises made, and I have to tell you, though, Teamster members remember those promises, and they intend to hold the leadership accountable. That's the kind of response that we're getting from Teamster members out here in the field, and I'm just very gratified by that. They're really paying attention. When Hoffa took office, we had a system, and we've had historically in the union a system of multiple salaries and multiple pensions, and that's where officers, because they get an additional title, can get an additional salary as well. And unfortunately, over the years, what that's developed into is just a huge patronage system where, officers are given an additional title and maybe $20,000 a year or 30 or 40 or whatever the number might be. And they're beholden to the international leadership as a result of that. Now, when Hoffa took office, there were 16 individuals at the international on multiple salaries. Now there are 168. So you see that's big problem and where a lot of our money has gone. I ask Teamsters wherever I go if they have seen more resources flow back to their local communities as a result of the dues increase, and the answer is always no. And I think that's so important because it's really in the local communities where the work of the union gets done. We're never going to be successful if we don't reach out to other progressive groups in the local communities, if we don't, deal with other unions and support their struggles and support working people's struggles in general in our local communities. A lot of our political action takes place at the local level. And we really need to see more of these resources in those local communities so that we can show that we're really an integral part of the local community, and we can help all workers in their struggles in the local community. So we really need to see more resources go to the local level. That's where the real work of the labor movement gets done.
Tom, I want to talk a little bit about the battle pages. And folks, the battle pages are contained within the Teamster magazine that's put out by the National Teamsters Union, and it's mailed to every member. And under the election supervisor rules, during the election cycle for top union officers, each candidate is allowed to put their campaign material in the magazine. The last three magazines have contained such material. Tom, in those battle pages, Hoffa seems to take some pretty hard hits at your reputation and your character. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, they really want me to spend my time trying to disprove a negative. And, you know, we just really don't want to spend a lot of time on that. We're talking about the issues that are important to Teamster members. You know, they've accused me. We were also, you know, we had a debate. And I might mention, Bill, that these battle pages, the debate, the election process, all of these things, we have these things because of the RICO settlement that you mentioned early on. And the government was, back in 1989, was about to trustee our union. And a number of us, including Teamsters for a Democratic Union, I know you're going to have Ken Paff on later, we fought to bring democracy to the Teamsters. We told the government, you know, give us the right to vote and we'll clean up our own union. Give us the right to vote for top officers. And unfortunately, many unions don't have that right. And because we were successful in winning that right, we have an election in the Teamsters. We have an opportunity to debate the issues, and we have an opportunity to hold our leaders accountable. So that's where all this has come from. We have democracy in the Teamsters, but we really just have sort of our toe in the door of democracy. And, you know, it remains to be seen whether it lasts in the union. I know the current leadership would look forward to a coronation rather than an election, and they would, I'm sure, like to avoid the election. So they have a tendency to throw out some outrageous charges. They've accused me of stealing $1 million or something, and a number of other charges. They just try to see whatever will stick, and the election administrator has ruled that it's okay to lie because these are campaign, this is just normal campaigning in their estimation. We don't think it is, but that's what they've indicated. And the fact of the fact is that my name has never been associated with any wrongdoing or any kind of scandal in the union. My name has never been mentioned in any reports, investigations. I've never had any charges filed against me. So these are just outrageous lies. And, you know, Hoffa's got a record that he cannot defend. And it's not uncommon that when you have a record that you can't defend, you just try to tear down your opponent's reputation. And that's essentially what they're trying to do. But I'll tell you what, it is not resonating with Teamster members. They've heard it before. They recognize that that these are just campaign lies, and they want to talk about the real issues that are affecting their working lives and their families, and that's what we're focusing our attention on.
Right. And if you just joined us, we're talking to Tom Latham, candidate for national president of the Teamsters Union. James P. Hoffa has been invited to tonight's program, but as yet has not phoned in. Tom, one last question. I know you want to get back to the plant gates and talk to more Teamster members about the future of this union. One last question. You brought it up. In August, there was one scheduled debate between the two candidates. Again, Hoffa failed to appear. You were there and discussed issues. Why do you think Hoffa... I find it unfathomable that he would not show up and discuss in 1 hour, talk to Teamster members about our union past and present. Why do you think he did that, and how do you think that's going to affect people who vote in this election?
Well, I believe he has a record that's just cannot be defended. And I'll tell you, Teamster members are aware of the fact that he was a no-show at the debate. His campaign argued successfully to be allowed under the rules. The discussions were going on about election rules, the debate is mandated in the rules. There has to be a debate. But when you start talking about the rules of the debate, one of the things that they argued for, well before the debate, several months in advance of the debate, was the ability to send a stand-in to the debate. And unfortunately, they won that ability. They won that right to send a stand-in to the debate. Most Teamsters just cannot understand how you could have a stand-in at a debate. It just doesn't make any sense to anyone. And I think it was a big mistake to not attend the debate and to defend his record. And Teamsters are asking the question, if he can't defend his own record, how can he defend our contracts and how can he defend our union? And I don't know why he didn't, other than he has a record that's indefensible. But I think it was a tactical blunder, and it's something that's being recognized by Teamster members around the country.
And if you are a Teamster member and you want a free copy of the DVD, that would be the hour-long debate. You can call the election supervisor at 1-888-428-2600. And ask them for a free DVD of the debate. They'll send it to your home within a few days. Again, that's 1-888-428-2600. Tom, do you have a website? And if people want to get involved, how do they get involved? And how does all that happen?
You know, I would encourage any union members, and not just Teamsters. You know, we're fighting to bring real democracy to the Teamsters and the labor movement. That's what we're really pushing for with our direct election of officers and debating the issues and so forth. And I would encourage any union members, whether they be Teamsters or members of other unions, to go to our website, see the kinds of things that we're doing. You can view the debate. And again, the debate was between me and a stand-in, not Hoffa. But I think you'll find it very interesting. And there are other videos on the website. It's leedham2006.org. That's leedham, L-E-E-D-H-A-M, 2006.org. You can see the flyers that we're using at the plant gates around the U.S. and Canada on various issues and for various types of workers within the Teamsters Union. You can view a number of short videos, and you can also view the debate itself. So I would just encourage Teamsters and other union members. We're trying to revitalize the labor movement. We're trying to put some life back into it. And I would encourage you to go to the website and check out the information there.
Well, Tom Leedham, candidate for national president of the Teamsters Union, I really want to thank you for taking time out. I know you've been hitting that campaign trail pretty hard. And in case folks don't know, some Teamster members get up at 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning. I know you've been out at the gate at those times and continue on till late in the evening. So I really appreciate you taking time out of that busy schedule and coming in and talking to us. And if Brother Hoffa ever does show up and call us, I'm sure I have a few questions I'd like to ask him. So, Tom, again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. Good night.
Thank you. And also on the phone tonight, we have Ken Paff, national organizer for Teamsters for Democratic Union. And Ken, welcome back to Labor Radio.
Hello, glad to be here.
Ken, first of all, let's talk a little bit about what Teamsters for Democratic Union is.
A week ago, we had our 30th anniversary. We're a long-lasting, durable, in fact, the most long-lasting reform movement in the history of American labor. And I think one reason we've been able to stick around and survive and grow is that we try to stick to our principles. The name sums it up. We're Teamsters. We're 100% for the union, for labor. for a democratic union. I think when we started out thinking democratic means have all your democratic rights, and we've kind of grown in how we see democratic and started to put some of the burden on ourselves, on members. These members got to participate, become part of the union, call it our union, not the union, and take ownership of the union. And that may mean pushing some people aside that are dead wood, but it mainly means getting more involved and developing more leaders, more knowledge, and more willingness to sacrifice if necessary and get involved at all times.
Right. So, Ken, you started out as a driver in local 407, I believe, in Cleveland, Ohio?
That's right.
And then was asked to become the national organizer of Teamsters for a Democratic Union. How long ago was that, and what's gone on in that time?
In TDU was formed in 76. I was a driver in Cleveland, as you say. I worked under what's called a National Master Freight Agreement. At that time, it was the largest Teamster contract. And by 79, I quit my job. And so I've been working for many years, for all these years, for our movement, for TDU. I've been honored and happy to work for the members. Never thought it would be this long, that's for sure, when I took the job in 79. And we have been able to win a heck of a lot in that period. After 13 years of our existence, in 1989, we were able to win the right to vote for Teamster members, to choose the top Teamster leaders, which was a signal victory.
So that just
a real transforming moment.
That right to vote just didn't happen out of some government lawsuit. I mean, there was a lot of work that went in to get to that government lawsuit.
Yes, quite a bit of work, because the government lawsuit, you know, over 100 pages filed at the time by U.S. Attorney Rudy Giuliani, who has since, as you know, become a prominent politician, former mayor of New York City. And at the time, he was making a name for himself as a U.S. attorney. In his complaint of over 100 pages, never mentioned anything about the words like vote and democracy never appeared. We intervened in the lawsuit, put a lot of leverage against the U.S. attorney, and intervened in favor of, our slogan was, no mob control, no government control, give Teamsters the right to vote. And we were successful in writing the linchpin or most critical part, I would say, of the what came to be called the consent order on the Teamsters, and gave Teamsters the right to vote in 1989. In 1986, it was a Teamster convention in where else? Las Vegas. And Jackie Presser held, quote, the funeral of TDU right on the convention floor. I don't mean outside at his hotel room or something. I mean, officially, it's in the minutes. He held the funeral of TDU. He was elected with 99% of the vote. 5 years later, all those people that had been elected with 99% of the vote were swept out of office once the members had the right to vote. What a difference from 99% to losers they went in 1991. So the members' right to vote started to open up the union, which was not looking forward, not taking on the challenges of the labor movement. As long as they had fat salaries, a lot of the officials became content with the situation of managing the decline of the union and of the labor movement, and the members weren't happy with that situation because they were suffering under it, and started to take matters into their own hands.
Right.
That was one thing that TDU is especially proud of. We won a number of other victories over the years. At that time, we had a very bad clause in our Teamster Constitution. If one-third of the workers voted in favor of a contract that passed, well, of course, the employer, whether you work for Safeway, United Parcel Service, or some small company, if the employer only has to get one-third to vote yes, of course, they're going to offer less, and they're going to try to divide the workers and find one-third that might have some slightly different interest or something. And we were able to defeat that and win majority rule on contracts.
So,
numerous other victories of that sort that we fought for to build a stronger, more democratic union and would draw in more members.
Ken, let me go back to that two-thirds rule, because it's called the two-thirds rule, and I want to be clear on this, because I think some union members are not aware that their union has a two-thirds rule, and I know where I work, one of the machinist unions just got caught up in a two-thirds rule, where they voted down a contract and then took a strike vote, and it missed by one vote to be two-thirds, and even though they had just voted down that contract, I guess apparently they accepted the contract because they couldn't go on strike. And so what that means is that two-thirds of the people have to vote to not accept a contract instead of a simple majority. And that, to me, seems like a major cornerstone of old guard in unionism, you know, that talk about the backroom deals in smoke-filled rooms. To me, that's a national, in the national constitution, that could not have been an easy thing to change. How did you go about taking on the entire Teamsters International Union to change a rule that I'm sure they were in love with?
Well, it was interesting how that came about. What happened in the 1980s, TDU began to grow and be a network, a place where Teamsters could come together. The first Teamsters that came together were those under national contracts who would start to link up, especially under the big trucking contracts, the United Parcel Service, the car haulers, the freight haulers, which is where I came out of what's called the National Master Freight Agreement. All three of those contracts at various times became imposed using minority rule. TDU would be campaigning against an agreement, and the majority would vote no, and it would be imposed. Well, most members hadn't studied their union constitution, 180 pages long. They didn't even know such a rule existed. What are you talking about? The majority voted no, and it passed. Well, it became a very educational event. It happened in the United Parcel Service. It happened twice among car haulers. When it happened among freight haulers, and 36% voted yes, and the contract was imposed, it was a stunning issue. And it bred such discontent and such support for TDU that the top leaders had to act. And so suddenly all the people that had said, oh, we must never, ever allow majority. Top leaders, international vice president today, Chuck Mack from Oakland, California, had spoken on the floor of the Teamster Convention in the 80s. We must have this two-thirds to reject rule. This is important. TDU is full of crap. All of a sudden, these people started saying, well, maybe we better let them have it. And we actually, it was a movement of workers who were rejecting their contracts and then becoming angry that they were imposed anyway. And they were having to be... These were concessions that people were taking. In other words, the employer was having their way too easily when 64% would vote no against the employers and would be imposed. And that's really what the engine that led to changing the two-thirds rule and having it abolished and getting a more democratic Teamster Constitution in the process.
So Ken, what I'm hearing here you saying is that Teamsters for a Democratic Union educates members on things like constitutional changes or constitution, what the Constitution says, why they've been affected by that. And you mentioned earlier about the 30th convention. What happens at those conventions?
Well, the Teamster conventions are held every 5 years, which
no, I mean the Teamsters for the Teamsters Democratic Union convention.
Yes, what's that?
The Teamsters for Democratic Union.
Oh, our own convention.
Yes,
we have conventions
yes.
every year.
Right.
And our conventions are like a Teamster university and a Teamster networking center. We hold dozens of workshops. We try to learn from each other. We bring in experts, learn from experts, but we bring out the best in each other and learn from what's happening in each other's locals and contracts and try to take that back and spread it. We also develop educational programs for a convention that then we can hold around the country in different areas to get members better informed on their contracts, on their basic democratic rights, and on how to build a better labor movement, how to build a stronger labor movement, how to unite with the community. The labor movement right now, we all know it's on the defensive, but one element of that is you don't have enough membership, involvement, ownership, awareness, and commitment to the labor movement. And that's what we're trying to build. That's part of that word democratic, that we take take responsibility for our own organization and realize that without the labor movement, we'd be truly a two-tier society.
So if I'm a Teamster and I want to come to this convention and I want to learn how to do certain things, I would be able to attend. And what do I do? Go, like, to a classroom? Who's there teaching what? And what type of subjects am I learning?
Well, that's exactly right. And a first step would be to consider, checking out TDU. Look at our website, www.tdu.org. That's easy enough. Or contact us another way. And even if you're not a Teamster, take a look at our website anyway. We're talking about issues for the labor movement as a whole. And that's a first step. Our convention is our annual event where we not only elect the top, the leaders of our own movement, but learn from each other and share experiences to build a stronger movement.
Ken, one of the things that I was reading lately was a newsletter called Convoy Dispatch. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, we put out a monthly newspaper, Convoy Dispatch. And again, we're trying to... It's partisan. Right now it's very partisan because we have a Teamster election going on. And you had earlier on your show, you had Tom Leadham from Oregon, and TDU is solidly behind Tom Leadham for Teamster president. So we're in a very partisan period right now. If you look at Convoy Dispatch, though, it's also ruthlessly honest and informative and educational and talking to people about the issues of our union and our industries. And, you know, the corporations are looking down the road. They're not standing there looking at their shoes. If you're dealing with United Parcel Service, the largest transport corporation in the world, and too often our labor leaders are standing there looking at their shoes. They're looking at next week, next month, next contract, next election, next golf game, whatever it is, good, bad, or indifferent. And in TDU, we try to be forward-looking. Our publication, Convoy Dispatch, is for Teamsters looking at critical issues that we face as a union, and also some things that we might do about them. Here's what people are doing about these and how you can start, whether it's in your local, at your shop, in your company, on a large or small scale, to make a difference.
The particular issue of Convoy Dispatch I was looking at had something in it called the $100,000 Club. You want to explain what that is?
Well, this has become a TDU classic. We've been doing this, I believe it started in 1979. We figured out that you could get publicly filed forms, what's called an LM2 report. LM stands for Labor Management, it's United States Department of Labor form. And every labor union, every local, every international, every labor union in the United States files one. And you could take a look at it and look at the finances. And, of course, the unions are all looking at these, and the employers are all looking at these, but the members weren't. They're filed away in a dusty office in Washington, D.C. And we started obtaining all of them. It's a pain in the butt. It's difficult. We get interns who do a lot of the research on this. And we started compiling and looking at the fact that Teamster officials were putting together multiple salaries, were paying themselves, their family, their relatives. And a lot of the resources of the union were being diverted there. And even worse, it was concentrating a certain sort of patronage machine and getting away from the labor as a movement instead of and becoming labor as top officials getting in the upper class. And so we have published the $100,000 Club, and just publishing this, we've done a lot of other things, but just publishing this has had a very salutary effect within our union. The salaries have had to come down by shining a light on this issue. And we have a much different... We still have the problem today. It's still needed, but it's much better than it was, because we had people that were making $500,000 in multiple salaries in the 1980s, which would be $1 million today, and no labor official should be doing anything like that. And we still have too many making over $200,000, some of whom represent low-paid workers, some of whom represent well-paid truck drivers that our unions fought hard for. But still, they're collecting multiple salaries, multiple pensions, and they're getting away from the principles of the labor movement. And the workers are not going to say our union. They're going to say the union when they look at that kind of setup.
Right, and you talked about an LM2. That's just not for Teamsters, is it? I mean, any union member has a right to an LM2 out of their local.
Unless your union only has public workers, there are certain exceptions, but basically any union, any local or international or any other branch of a union, files what's called an LM2 report. It's a financial report, and it has a lot more than the salaries. It has other information in it, and you know, we think union members need to inform themselves and get more involved within the union. So, we'll have top officials say, you shouldn't be printing that. Why, the employers will see that. As if United Parcel Service hasn't looked these things up. That's so stupid.
Exactly.
It's one of those, quote, secrets, which is only a secret from the 1.4 million members. The union officials know about it. The employers know about it. It's like when they have bargaining and they say, don't reveal what happens there. It's a secret. How the hell can it be a secret? The employer was sitting at the bargaining table. The only people it's a secret from are the members. So frequently we're the people bringing the members in on the secret, whether it's what's happening in bargaining or what's happening with our union as a whole or even the union finances.
So Ken, I'm sitting here listening to some of the things you're saying about, you know, I hear education of membership, and we're talking about the $100,000 club and a monthly newsletter to talk about what's happening in this part of the country or that part of the country and what Teamster members are doing about it. I guess I'm a little confused because, to me, anytime you educate members on what's happening in their union is a good thing. Yet so often, like particularly at the last Teamster convention, I hear the words TDU sucks. I just don't get that. Maybe it's the people who's saying it. I don't know. Can you address that issue for me, please?
Well, this is a favorite slogan of some of the top Teamster officials. TDU sucks. I think what's threatening is the fact that TDU is organized. And they'll often say this, we don't mind you complaining, but why do you have to have TDU? Well, of course, an individual complaining has no impact. It's just a way to blow off steam. Any dictator in the world, in fact, they like complaining. People like to blow off steam. I've always found owners are not very effective as they're going to belly ache off. And we in TDU offer people information, but also networking and organization. If you bunch up, you can be more effective. We have the right to vote within the Teamsters, but how could someone run in a 1.4 million members union dispersed over all of North America? The Hoffa campaign in their war chest has raised over $3 million. Well, one individual isn't going to be able to run against them. Only a network of people that have organized together and learned their rights and reinforced each other and are willing to raise money and retain attorneys and so on is going to be effective in doing anything, whether it's, you know, running for office within the union or taking on any other problem at United Parcel Service or elsewhere. And that's where I think that's what's threatening about TDU, that people are getting together, learning their rights, organized, and TDU has a reputation of not backing down.
Right. So what I'm hearing here is...
They have a lot of attacks on TDU, and one of them that I actually embrace is they're never satisfied. This is one of the things they hate about TDU. They'll use extra. They're never satisfied. Well, I think too often in the labor movement, we don't want to be satisfied all the time.
Right.
We want to be a bit dissatisfied.
So in other words, the best way to scare a cockroach is shine a light on him, and the cockroach probably doesn't like the light being shined on him either, I suppose.
And that's exactly it. They don't like the light being shined on what's going on.
So, Ken, we have about 30, 40 seconds left. What's the website again, and anything to close with?
Well, anyone who wants to take a look at what TDU is about, www.tdu.org. And I like to think that we're about bringing out the best in each other and fellow union members and looking toward the future of the labor movement. Right now in this country is a fight to raise the minimum wage about $5.15, and that's the most pitiful thing you can imagine. And we've got to turn that around by building a much stronger, broader, more diverse labor movement, and we're going to do our part within the Teamsters.
Okay. Well, Ken, I appreciate you taking time out and calling us up and talking to us about Teamsters for Democratic Union. Sounds to me like it's a group that educates and talks to members about their rights and shows them what has worked with other members throughout the union. And I would advise people, if you're interested, not only Teamster members, but any member, to visit. And again, that was TDU.org.
That's right.
Okay, TDU.org. Ken Paff, national organizer from Teamsters from a Democratic Union, thank you for coming on and talking to us.
Thank you. Keep doing the good work with your labor show.
Okay, thanks, Ken.
Take
Bye.
Care.
Mm-hmm. And right now we'll go to underwriting.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from SEIU Local 503 OPEU, whose mission is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day. And also by Ironworkers, Shopmen's Local 516, and the Pacific Northwest Ironworkers District Council, proudly fighting to preserve living wage jobs and resisting their outsourcing. Information at 503-257-4743.
And welcome back to Labor Radio. I'm your host, Bill Zimmerman. We've talked to Tom Leadham tonight about the national Teamster election going on, and also Ken Paff from Teamsters for a Democratic Union. And on the phone right now, we have Dan Denver from PCAST. Dan, welcome to Labor Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me, Bill.
So, Dan, tell us, what is PCAST?
PCAST is the Portland Central America Solidarity Committee. And we've been fighting for 26 years for justice throughout all of the Americas, both in Latin America and for working people in the U.S.
And I would imagine a lot of that has to do with the race to the bottom, as we see wages in this country head downhill.
Oh, yeah, as we see wages head downhill and jobs head down south, and they're not good jobs for the people in Latin America, and that's one of the big messages that we're bringing to union people and working people in Oregon, is that it's not just that the jobs are leaving here, but that they're using that, they're changing the rules of the economy down there and really screwing people on that end too.
So we're not raising the standard of living in Central America like we were promised.
Oh, not at all. I mean, it's a huge myth. I mean, I found in conversations that I've had about free trade, you know, our organization has a lot of allies in Mexico and Latin America. And when I talk to working people in Oregon about the struggles and the difficulties and the oppression that workers in Mexico and Latin America are facing because of these free trade deals, it's kind of a relief, because what they hear from the corporate media all the time is that, oh, these selfish protectionist, you know, U.S. workers who don't care about the workers down there. Well, that's not true. Unions and the, you know, labor movement in Latin America is right with them in opposing these free trade deals.
So, Dan, Sunday night I got a call from someone, and they were talking about an event that's going on. I believe it was Friday night.
Yes.
You want to talk about that a little bit?
We have a farm worker leader from Colombia, Renee Cho, who will be speaking this Friday, October 6th at 7 p.m., and that'll be taking place at SEIU Local 49, which is located at 3536 Southeast 26th Avenue in Portland. And you can find more information on our website, which is www.pcasc.net. And this is an important event. He's going to be talking about the Colombian fight against the Andean Free Trade Agreement, which is basically Bush and his corporate friends trying to push NAFTA and CAFTA down to South America, and also about their fights against U.S. military intervention. And for Portland, it's really the kickoff to our fight against the Peru Free Trade Agreement and the Andean Free Trade Agreement, which they're going to try to start pushing right after the fall elections, like the day after.
Yeah.
And we have a big problem in Oregon, which is that Democratic Senator Ron Wyden and Democratic Representative Earl Blumenauer say that they're undecided on that. So I think they probably need to hear from some listeners.
How can you be undecided? I'm sorry. I just have a problem in that area. Take a look around. You know, I remember Ross Perot, and I really didn't understand it then, but I definitely get it now, the sucking sound toward the south.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, Dan, give us that address and time and date again.
It's this Friday, October 6th, 7 p.m. at SEIU Local 49, which is located at 3536 Southeast 26th Avenue.
And when people come there, they can expect to hear?
They can expect to hear Renee talking about the fight down there against the free trade agreement that the Bush administration and the Colombian right-wing president are trying to push, and also probably some words from local labor activists about the effects of free trade here.
Okay, Dan, we only have about a minute left, so here's what I want to do. This is a very interesting subject to me. I'd like to invite you back in on Labor Radio. Only we'll give you about 20, 25 minutes, and we can talk about, you know, this event, you know, after it has happened, of course, and where you're at the time you come on. So I'm probably looking at something in early November.
That sounds great. In early November, we're going to be sending a labor delegation from Oregon and Washington down to Colombia and Venezuela.
Okay.
We have representatives from 8 Oregon and Washington unions.
Well, Dan, I'm at laborradio@AOL.com. It's all one word, laborradio@AOL.com. Send me an email and so I don't forget.
Sure thing.
Okay, Dan, thanks. Appreciate you calling
in. Thanks very much, Bill.
Uh-huh.
Take care.
And with that, folks, we'll close another episode of Labor Radio, and I thank you for listening.
Listen up, we've got a war zone here today right in our heartland. And across the USA, these multinational bastards don't use tanks and guns, it's true. But they've declared a war on us, my back, it's up to you. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Could be the death of you and me, but we're not unarmed. Our weapon's solidarity. Jim Beals and Karen Silver.